All right, so the idea was to talk about international plans, and what I will really talk about, which is something that I think is even more interesting, which is international cooperation, if such a thing exists. So we will try and address that from various points of view. All right, so here's the outline of what I'm going to talk about. First, just looking at some facts, what exoplanet missions are planned today, or semi-exoplanet missions, things that are relevant, and what are possible, and what nations and what times are involved, just to get a little lay of the land here. Then, what kind of science can we do with these missions that are planned right now, and what new areas should we be thinking about, because we may not be addressing all possible areas with the planned missions. And then I'll dwell a little bit on the mechanisms of international cooperation on missions, and in these cases, I'm always talking about space missions, not ground-based stuff. And then some concluding thoughts on this. All right, so here is a list of the missions that I'm aware of, and let me just go through them a little bit. The top group here out of the four groups, there's four groups here, so let's just look at the top group first. This Herschel has some relevance. It looks at disks and so on. And what I've done is to list the dates and the lifetimes so that I can get an ending date to find out when this mission is going to be essentially over with and we should be looking for something else. So it was launched last year and it's cold and it has a three-year lifetime, and so it will almost guarantee to be ended in 12. It's in an L2 orbit. And on the topic of this talk, it is a cooperative event mission between ESA and NASA, which is good. Crow was launched at the end of 2006, and it had an extension. It has a lifetime and then an extension. So I believe right now the end date is about 2013, and it's in low Earth orbit. And of course, it was launched. It was initiated by CNES and France and taken up as an ESA mission. So it's a cooperative, within international, I guess, there. Kepler, of course, we've heard a lot about, was launched this time last year. It had a lifetime of 3.5 years. I've rounded everything off, and it has an extension of 2 years. 2 years, I guess, right? And so it'll go to about 2014, and it's in an Earth-trailing orbit. So I suppose at some point, even you can't extend it much beyond that because you just run out of communication ability. But get down to 3 and 4. Yeah. So, oh, and gas also? Okay. And it is a purely NASA mission. Spitzer, of course, is up there. It began its warm phase about this time last year. I actually didn't find out what the total length of that warm phase is. I'm not sure it's 5 years, but it will end at least by this date here, and it's also in an Earth-trailing orbit. HST is up there, and it's since service mission 4 last year, it has nominally 5 years to go. Who knows? I mean, this may be going after we're all long gone. I mean, HST is just amazing. It never stops. And it is a cooperative mission, so that's good in this context. And SOFIA I put in here because it is, well, first of all, it's cooperative between NASA and Germany. It may have some relevance to exoplanets. They had their first flight this year, first open door flight, and it's nominally supposed to go for 10 years. So it's an airborne, it's not an orbital mission. So this is the list that I'm aware of right now of things that we know will fly. And then there are two that are spoken of often and that are in the works. Gaia is going to be launched apparently in 2012, in 2 years, and it should have a five-year life. It's at L2, and it's a purely ESA mission. And SPICA, is expected. It's a Japanese mission, and it may have some collaboration. See, now we're getting into the uncertain territory here. It may have some collaboration with ESA. And it may have some collaboration with NASA, but these are all TBD. It would have a five-year life. It's got cryogens, and so it would actually go through 2020 sometime. And then, of course, JWST is in this same category of things that are being built right now, and it's being planned to be launched around 2014 and have a 10-year life. So it'll actually go through the middle of the next decade at L2. And it's a collaboration between NASA and ESA and the Canadian Space Agency. And then we get into italics because everything is very uncertain below this point. So one possibility is of a mission that's been named is SIM. And everything below this point depends upon whether or not the ASTRO 2010 committee decides that A, whether exoplanets are interesting, and B, whether there's anything we should do about it in this decade. So it would launch in the latter part of the decade and would go through about 22 and would be Earth trailing. And at the moment is a NASA mission, but there are possibilities that it could be a collaboration with CNES or with ESA. And then in the final category, here are things that don't even have names yet. There are two types of missions that people have been talking about at NASA, at least. And there is a corresponding set of types in Europe, but I just didn't list all of them here. All right, so there are medium probes. The word medium and probe are supposed to sort of go together, and they're synonymous, and it means... what did I do? All right. It means missions that have a cost without the launch vehicle that are below $800 million, approximately. And so things that could go into this category are multitudinous. A coronagraph, a starshade, that's a coronagraph with the blocking part way on the outside, some kind of interferometer, a small interferometer. These would all be moderate size, small missions. Possibly a gravitational lensing mission, a transit survey. And at the moment, these are NASA missions that we're talking about. And then, of course, there's the possibility of a large mission, which, depending upon the budget and the recommendations at NASA, could or could not occur. And that large mission could be a coronagraph, for example. It could be the Terrestrial Planet Finder coronagraph. It could be a starshade, in which case it would be a Terrestrial Planet Finder occulter. Or it could be an interferometer, in which case you just put an I at the end of the sentence. But in any case, these are several billion-dollar missions, presumably. So these are all the things that I'm aware of that we're talking about at the moment. Question?
Not so much a question, but I would be surprised that you don't have thought that's fair, but that there are some places that are
Good point. It will come up. You're right. I guess should have been in this same line here, at the same level of something which is being discussed and could well happen.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. Okay, so here's Plato. Okay. All right, so I'm interested in looking at these from the point of view of which stars are we looking at. And one way of looking at it is to say what distance range from the sun are we talking about? And in the very far category, these are very technical terms here, I put distances in extremely round numbers. So, you know, if it really works from 1 kiloparsec, don't complain to me. It's just, I wanted to keep them all the same. All right, anyhow, it's gravitational microlensing. And it's a good example of something that just checks for stars that are really, really far away. In the far distance category, the second line here is because this is not yet a mission and there is none up here for it. And we have an existing mission, Kepler, and there may be future ones down here that work in the 1 kiloparsec range and will be measuring stars at those distances. And of course, the reason why it matters whether something is far or near is because if it's too far away, you can't do any follow-up on it. You can't do radial velocity. You can't do characterization with spectroscopy. Stars get pretty faint. All right, so in the middle distance, so let's just assume that there's a middle distance between where Kepler is and what's our near neighborhood. I would say that Corot is in there. It's looking at things that are not necessarily the nearest 100 stars. It's farther than that. Gaia will be in there, an astrometric mission, which has some relevance to exoplanets because it will have some accuracies that you can use at the giant planet level, and JWST. So these are missions that are either up or being built. And then the line down here is for things that could be in the future, and that's why it's in italics and in parentheses. Plato, which would be a European mission, transit surveys, which could be from either side, or large missions, as I discussed before. And the main point is that this would search regions that are not in the immediate stellar neighborhood, solar neighborhood. And then in the nearer neighborhood, I put 2 to 20 parsecs, more or less. And the reason I'm interested in the nearer neighborhood is because this is the place where we can put characterization, spectroscopic characterization. You know, you heard from Lisa Kaltenegger about how to characterize Earth-like planets. You can't really do that in at these distances. You need something that's close enough so that you can angularly resolve the planet from the star or null out the star. And so there's a benefit to be gained from having something that's nearby. Yes. Ten, really? Okay. But your median star distance is at like 12th magnitude. Median distance is certainly out in this.
Well, we're looking at 3,000 dwarfs.
Yeah. Which are closer. Which are closer. Yeah, definitely closer. Yeah. Really? Okay. This is a fairly crude categorization. I knew that you were going to complain about it. I am trying to push the near category. That's my purpose here. Not to cast aspersions on anybody else's experiment. Okay, so the kinds of things that we're doing, and I will lead to that same topic through this chart here. The kind of science that we're doing right now with things that are far away and that we're doing with current time frame are mass statistics. I mean, this is what we've been hearing about all week here, the statistics of masses of planets, the orbits, by which I include all, you know, orbital parameters and the correlations between these. And these are, you know, really wonderful things to be measuring, and we're doing it by transit depths, transit times, and radial velocity. And you get this from surveys or radial velocity on the ground. If you want to hear about atmospheres of giant planets, we haven't heard much about it during the meeting, but you now are looking with colors or transit colors or transit spectra, I should say. And this is, of course, being done with HST and Spitzer, a little bit from the ground, and a lot will be done presumably from JWST. So we've got this to look forward to in this time frame here. Then there are things that I don't think that we know anything about and that I think we do need to learn something about. And the first one would be the exozodi brightness, because if we want to do imaging missions at some point, either in the infrared or the visible, we need to know what the zodiacal light background is. And it may also tell us something interesting about what's going on in the evolution of the planetary system, as we heard this morning about things from the Kuiper belt, which produces dust. So we need to know the brightness and the shape in both the visible and the infrared, or at least one of these categories here, and then we can extrapolate to the other. And the way you do that is with some kind of nuller and photometry on the star. And by a nuller, I mean something like the Keck interferometer, which experiment we have already finished, or the Large Binocular Telescope interferometer, which will come up in about 2 years, and which is, in fact, a joint European-US experiment. And you can also do, I can tell you now that our experiments with the Keck interferometer have gotten down to a nominal brightness on zodis of about zero plus or minus 100 times the solar system, which is way too much for an imager. So we need to get down farther, and the Large Binocular Telescope will probably get down another order of magnitude below that. And it remains to be seen whether or not that will be sufficient. You can certainly study this with a coronagraphic probe or an interferometric probe, lower cost, smaller missions in some unknown time frame here. Then, if you know what the brightness is, you feel brave enough to go out and look for terrestrial planets in the habitable zones around stars, things like the Earth perhaps, measure their orbits and masses. And right now, the only way that I know of doing this is with astrometry and astrometric mission coupled with radial velocity. And focusing on the nearby stars. You could also do it with a coronagraph mission, which just goes out and images things and waits for planets to come around. But there are some, much as I love coronagraphs, it's a little bit more direct to do it with astrometry. And you could also do it with a starshade, which also has its geometric limitations and these orbital limitations too. So these are possibilities, but I think the direct way of getting orbits and masses and knowing for sure what you've got is through astrometry. And that's the space interferometer mission coupled with radial velocity. And there are no plans at the moment for doing that, no firm plans. And then finally, what I think is the interesting thing that we want to get to, or some of us want to get to, is the atmospheres and the surfaces of terrestrial planets in the habitable zone and searching for signs of life. And to do that, you need some tremendously more complicated instruments. You need annular, and you want to see spectra of these planets. And you'd like to do it in both the visible and in the infrared. And right now, I think we're stuck with the laws of physics, the laws of diffraction, and the counting statistics of photons, which means that you need a large coronagraph or a large star shade, which is basically, you know, some. For example, this could be an external occulter that goes with the JWST. Or a large interferometer in the infrared. So you need something fairly large in order to accomplish these tasks someday. Okay, just a collection of agencies that are potential collaborators here. There's NASA. And I Googled their web pages to find out what their budgets are. And I do not stand by these numbers. I'm just telling you this is what you get if you Google their web pages. All right, so the NASA budget, I would have said it was around 20, 21 billion, but it says 17.6 on the last page that I looked at. ESA has something that is substantially much smaller than that, and it may be even smaller than this. I have contradictory information on that. But it is substantially smaller than NASA's budget. And I mean, you want to think about these numbers when you think about partners, you know, how much can they contribute? So, but as most of you know, this is just the part that ESA pays for of a mission, which is to get the spacecraft and to get the lift into space. And the instruments are frequently paid for by the national, by the entity states of ESA, so France, Germany, and so on. Usually contribute about half of the cost of a mission. So effectively, the cost of the effective dollar value is much greater. And then there's JAXA in Japan, which has a somewhat smaller budget, and the German Space Agency, 1.8, and Canada. And just because they haven't entered in here before, I list the other possible ones. Once upon a time, Roscosmos would have been a great place to collaborate with. They have rockets, which is a good thing. China has no plans that I'm aware of at the moment, and India has no plans, at least in extrasolar planet area at the moment. Fine. Okay, so if you want to do cooperative missions, there always seems to be a big barrier between cooperating between agencies because they have different schedules, different agendas, different constituencies, but it's worth trying. So I want to address that for the next couple of slides. First of all, doing this cooperation is common. There's advantages to each side. It's lower cost. You know, you share it, you gain technology, broader science pool. You get some insurance against cancellation. This is the case in one of those, in the SOFIA mission that I showed you before. There's disadvantages, of course, because it increases the cost a little bit, makes it more complicated. And then there's ITAR, the United States rules against sharing information with anybody that does not have a United States passport, which are extremely unpleasant rules to deal with. Nevertheless, there are levels at which one can cooperate. There's informal cooperation at the scientist-to-scientist level within these ITAR rules. You know, you just call up a friend and work with them and make sure you don't break these rules. There's formal cooperation at a tactical level. In this case, you get a thing called a technical assistance agreement, which is between individual named scientists and their institutions and the United States State Department and NASA. And now that I work at NASA, I discovered that, you know, you have to go through this if you want to talk to somebody seriously from Japan or someplace else. And then there are things where you can propose for missions called standalone missions of opportunities, which is abbreviated to SAMON, and also that word MU, which means mission of opportunity. And in the United States, for NASA, there's a limit of $50 million. And so if you have an idea for something that would fit on a European or a Japanese mission and you want to propose it, you can get up to about that amount of money. So those are some levels of cooperation. And then at a more formal level, there is cooperation at a strategic level. I've distinguished that here between the agencies, and it typically has several stages. There are bilateral talks, such as just occurred during this last week, between NASA and ESA, and these typically occur at the associate administrator level, like Ed Weiler and under him, John Morse. And then, so these are discussions. And then after that, there can be exchanges of letters, which is our agreements to exchange documents. This sounds really boring, but this is what I was told, so, okay. And at a certain point, you start getting around these ITAR rules by getting coverage by having these agreements. Then there are letters of agreement, which occur apparently at the beginning of the formulation stages, and these are done at a fairly high level between the agencies. And then finally, there's an MOU at confirmation. Confirmation means, yes, the mission is going to go and we really have the money. And that involves the State Department, and it really commits NASA and ESA to doing what they said they were going to do. I suppose before this point, you can always back out. All right, now I have three examples. I didn't invent all this stuff myself. I inquired of people elsewhere. And so this is from Motohide Tamura in Japan. And his comments are summarized here briefly. He says, in general, Subaru, you know, telescope on Mauna Kea, has an international cooperation, especially for exoplanet work. And then the organizations in Japan are NAOJ, the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan, for ground-based work. And then they actually have a working group for the Japanese TPF, it's so-called. It has been for a while, and JAXA, of course, is the space mission. And in terms of cost, the maximums that they would be able to invest would be up to about $500 million, which is what he says the cost of Subaru is. And typically, their large missions have caps that are much smaller than that, about $130 million. So this morning, I got an email from Fabio Favata saying what ESA does. And so I've summarized it here. He says, of course, they welcome collaboration at all kinds of levels. And he gave several examples from small levels of cooperation on the X-ray missions to full payload cooperations or just sharing data, I think, basically, and antennas. Their pathways to getting something into the air is there's open calls. And then there are two levels of sifting. One is the lower level astronomy working group and other kinds of working groups. And then there is a space science advisory committee. So advice from these two groups gets passed up to David Southwood, and then they make a selection after many years of iteration. And there's, of course, a lot of layers of industrial work and proposals and re-proposals that go in the middle here. In terms of cost, he said, well, international cooperation adds, in his estimation, maybe 10% to the cost of a project. So if you think you're going to save 10% by cooperating with somebody, you won't make it. And there are all sorts of barriers to doing that. Second last slide. All right, so here is something slightly different in the way of advice from Jean-Jacques Hinault, a person that I knew from graduate school, but he apparently running a lot of the science for this thing called ITER, which is the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, this thing being built in France. And the interesting thing about this is that that's a sort of a large-scale mission, and it involves many nations. And I see the sign, thank you. And he goes on and says basically the same things that I've said, because it's short time now, that, you know, cooperation is a really good thing, but it makes you feel really good when you get done doing it, and it saves money. But it can be very difficult to get to that point. Last slide. So from my first slides, you saw that by the middle of the decade, we would have cataloged, you know, maybe a couple of thousand exoplanets, the orbits and sizes and masses of many of them. We'll have measured some atmospheres. We'll have theoretical explanations of planet formation I can see coming, and atmospheres that can account for most of these processes, I hope, right? But we will still not know anything about our immediate neighbors, which is kind of strange, the nearby terrestrial planets in the habitable zones. So I would just like to say that it would be good if we could do that. And to investigate if there are Earth-like planets and signs of life nearby, we need three steps. We need to know what the exozoides are. We need to inventory these planets to find out if they're really there. and where to look and when to look, and we need to eventually directly image these planets and obtain spectra of them. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Russ. I'll take questions now.
Nick Cowan, in your opinion, do you think it would be easier to come up with a project with like a mission concept that can answer lots of different science, including plenty of non-exoplanet stuff, or do you think we could go it alone and come up with a mission that's just doing exoplanets, you know, the equivalent of WMAP or something, but for exoplanets?
WMAP was not a billion-dollar mission, so there are two answers to that. Buried in here were different people's answers to that. You know, one person said, oh, it's a really good idea if you have a mission that can also do general astrophysics in addition to exoplanets. And another one said, oh, if it was an international project where different nations agreed, Japan, US, Europe, then it would be feasible to have a purely exoplanet mission. So I don't have an answer for that. It's somewhere in between there, I think. It's hard for me to imagine building a telescope that can look at planets that isn't going to do something else that's useful. It won't be a wide field imaging device, for example, but it'll be awfully good at narrow fields and faint objects.
Wes, one of the things people have been pursuing for years now is TPF and Darwin. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences and the international cooperation and development of those two concepts?
Well, there isn't any international cooperation on TPF, and in fact, TPF doesn't even exist as a project anymore. I sometimes wonder why I still have a job at JPL.
But it did for years.
It did for years, yeah. And when I first came there 5 years ago, it was, you know, going to go up and be a project. There was no cooperation with Europe on the coronagraph kind of TPF, because the Europeans were totally interested in interferometers for various reasons, scientific and industrial. And so their focus was entirely on the interferometer. And in the United States, you know, we studied the interferometer and the coronagraph. And on the other hand, Japan apparently is interested in the telescope version of it, of a coronagraph, as you could see from Japanese TPF. But there never has been any formal collaboration with Japan on it. So I don't know. All of this needs an endorsement. Any of these projects need an endorsement by Astro 2010. Projects that are not endorsed will probably be dropped and zeroed out. That's what will happen to them. They will disappear. And then all the work that has gone into them will be in books, and somebody will read about them in the next generation.
Okay, so in the spirit of causing trouble, I could sort of read this last slide of yours, and sort of the beginning of your talk is, you know, we've spent enough time trying to understand how planets form. Now it's time for us to start looking in our backyard and figuring out what's out there. And, you know, despite your rather rosy prediction that, you know, in by mid-century we're going to understand how planets form, I posit that, you know, if we don't continue to actually try to get additional statistics on even some of these very distant systems that you tend to disparage, we're not going to really understand planet formation. So I sort of think a balanced approach is probably the best way to go.
You'll notice I did mention gravitational microlensing.
You did, but you know, I would submit that was more lip service than anything else, because you knew that I was sitting in the audience.
It is true. It does a somewhat different part, as we saw before. You know, this week, you know, beyond the snow line, etc. But I still contend those are distant planets.
I might be mistaken, but I think the ALMA project is going to look into planet formation as well.
Which?
The ALMA project, which is ground-based.
Oh, okay. Ground-based, right. I ignored all 30-meter, 42-meter, you know, 6-kilometer, whatever they are, telescopes on the ground.
Right, it's a big international cooperation, I would say.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was really focusing a lot on space missions. And it is true that the ground-based projects are part of what Astro 2010 will be talking about, and for that matter, well, Cosmic Vision doesn't address ground-based telescopes, but
Well, since you did mention Plato by name, perhaps I should mention the Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite test, which was selected for Phase A, was not selected for a flight opportunity, but got very close. It's a small mission. It's going to be reproposed to the Explorer Opportunity, assuming that goes forward at the $200 million level. And that will survey relatively nearby stars because it's an all-sky survey.
Thank you, David. I didn't mean to leave it out. It was an unconscious omission. It is not the only survey mission that has been proposed, though, but it's the one that's gotten the farthest so far in the United States.
Other questions? Okay, why don't we...
We're free. We're free at last.
Okay, well, and before you get out, I'd like to, I guess we should all thank our show organizers, Adam Burrows and Krista Manu.
And of course, I think everyone felt the energy in the rooms during this week and in the halls. So I thank the audience as well for their not only coming, but participating in making this one of the most memorable conferences, certainly of this year. And but of course, such a conference would be impossible if it weren't for the staff. The staff of the KITP is quite practiced in this, and there are many people to thank, but I want to thank in particular Jocelyn Quick. And of course, the electronic support staff, but I also want to thank not only Kristen, as has already been done, but the attendees and the KITP for making this quite a memorable conference. So thank you very much, and enjoy your trips back.